if you don't have a mindset that can cope with failure, then you're going to let that failure absorb into your body and define you. The ones who don't let it define them are the ones who often succeed. So I get inside, and I got inside Mike's head to find out a little bit about that. And then I would create scenarios for him to fail, to watch how he responds to it.
Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piorro. You've just heard from Paulo Saldana. He's the head of performance at the World Team Israel Startup Nation. The Montrealer is one of many Canucks on that outfit. In fact, the Mike he mentions is Michael Woods, who he's been coaching for almost 8 years. Today, he's also working closely with Chris Froome. In this episode, Saldana and I discuss those two riders, as well as some of the cutting-edge training and technology research he's involved in. And it's not all science and data. There's the art of coaching, too. We cover it all. But before that interview, it's the Spring Classics. This episode is out just before opening weekend, featuring Omloop et Nieuwsblad and Kerna Brussels Kerna. Omloop et Nieuwsblad. I never say that right. And just seeing the word, say, Scheldeprijs, freaks me out. And Brabantsepil Pale? Ugh. As you can hear, I need some coaching on how to say the names of quite a few races that we'll be watching this spring. My coach is Canadian Cycling Magazine's own social media manager, Nikita Van Dyke. Have a listen to our conversation, not so much to hear me butchering other languages, but to improve your own pronunciation and impress your riding buddies. Hi, Nikita.
Hello.
Nikita Van Dyke is the social media manager of Gripped Publishing, which includes Canadian Cycling Magazine. And where are you from, Nikita?
So I'm from the Netherlands. I'm from a town called Haarlem, but the Dutch Haarlem.
The Dutch Haarlem.
Yeah. It's about 20 minutes from Amsterdam.
Okay. So Nikita, you are going to help me with my pronunciation of Flemish and also Dutch race and place names. Now, we should just say this is going to have the pronunciation is going to have more of a Dutch flavor than a Flemish flavor. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So it'll still be way more accurate than my Anglo-Canadian hoser pronunciation, which we will start with just to give people a baseline, because most of our listeners, I imagine, sound a bit more like me than you.
All right, sounds good.
All right, so we're going to start with the first of the classics of the season. Now, the word looks fabulous on the page, and this is how I would say it. Omloop et Nieuwsblad.
Okay, it's not bad, but the proper way to pronounce it is Omloop et Nieuwsblad. Omloop et Nieuwsblad.
Okay, I'm going to try that again. Omloop et Nieuwsblad.
Nieuwsblad.
Nieuwsblad?
Yeah, it's pretty close. Pretty close. Pretty good.
Well, you're too kind. All right, we'll move on to another race. Now, in a way, I can cheat with this one because it starts with a letter and a number, which is easy to anglicize. It is E3 Aarlbekke.
That's close. So if I were to pronounce it in Dutch, it's E3. Harelbeke. E3 Harelbeke.
E3 Harelbeke.
Beke.
Beke.
Yeah. Harelbeke. Pretty good.
Here's one that's two cities. And again, here's the quick Anglo version. Ghent Wevelgem.
Okay, this one might be a bit harder. So it's Ghent Wevelgem. Ghent Wevelgem.
Ghent Wevelgem.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, see, I have to not be afraid to go, which just does not happen in English.
I mean, usually people have a really hard time with that, and I'm impressed.
Great. Well, it's someone said English is a language afraid of phlegm, and Flemish is not. Gent.
Yeah. Wevelgem.
Wevelgem.
Just gotta go to. It's basically Dutch and Flemish. Just a lot of.
Next race, Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen.
That's not bad, actually. So Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen. Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen.
Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen.
Vlaanderen.
Vlaanderen. Do you have to roll my R? Drr.
Vlaanderen.
Vlaanderen. Yeah, Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen.
Vlaanderen.
No one can see this, but Nikita's eyes go wider when she's helping me to pronounce it better. Vlaanderen. I don't know. I'm going to maybe take this home and do some homework. However, the next race, the very famous Tour of Flanders, sounds very similar. Ronde van Vlaanderen.
Okay, so the first word is Ronde van Vlaanderen. So Ronde van Vlaanderen.
Ronde van Vlaanderen.
Yeah.
Ah, here's one that just looks insane on the page.
Yeah, that's a hard one.
Okay, good. My version is Scheldeprijs.
Okay, so no.
Just straight up no.
No. Okay, so Scheldeprijs. Scheldeprijs.
Scheldeprijs.
Prijs.
Prijs.
Yeah.
Scheldeprijs.
Yeah.
Again, I can't be afraid of the phlegm.
No. You just need to know how to pronounce it. Like, I don't blame you. It's a hard word. You're a fast learner.
Oh, you're too kind. Here's another funny one to my eyes. Brabantse pil. It looks like pill. I don't know what to do with the J in P-I-J-L.
Right, I get that. So it's Brabantse pijl. Brabantse pijl.
Brabantse pijl?
Pijl.
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 I almost want to say pale as in a bucket.
It's like pale.
Pale?
Yeah.
All right. Here's the easiest one, but I'm sure there's even some nuance I'll miss here. Amstel Gold.
Amstel Gold.
Amstel. Amstel. The beer.
Yeah. Gold. Yeah, can't go wrong with that.
Well, Nikita, thank you very much. You've given me some... Well, maybe homework, so I can work on my pronunciation.
I think you did pretty good. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We'll have to stay in touch as the races continue.
For sure.
Paulo Saldana has coached many successful athletes. I've already mentioned Woods and Froome, but before Saldana became the head of performance at Israel Startup Nation, he was already working with Alex Cataford, James Piccoli, and Guillaume Boivin. In fact, he connected with Boivin when the two of them were with the Canadian squad SpiderTech about 10 years ago. Saldana has been working in the field of sports science for some time. In the late 80s, he was a triathlete. During those years, he was also studying at McGill and doing work in the emerging field of training with power meters. Later, he founded PowerWatts, which today is a training system, a collection of indoor training studios, and even an app that Saldana uses with the pros. Saldana and I discuss Froome and Woods' training. Then we get into some big questions, like what role does failure play in the development of a successful athlete? And will the algorithm, the robo-coach, ever replace the human coach? And is cycling a fallback sport for athletes who don't succeed in other disciplines? That's a loaded question, I know, but I give it some context. I even asked Saldana to look into his crystal ball for what training innovations might be coming to more humble riders like those of us who aren't pros. We start with a curious photo that Chris Froome posted on social media. Paulo Saldana, There is a Twitter post that Chris Froome put up near the beginning of February. It reads, quote, "Can't tell if Paulo Powerwatz is happy with my numbers." Then there's some emojis, hashtag Powerwatz online in reference to your company. And there's a photo of Froome on his bike, on a trainer, in front of a laptop. You're next to him in a mask. Your glasses are perched on your forehead, and it's hard to read your expression. Maybe your eyebrows are raised. So what was on that laptop screen, really?
Many people want to know that. Essentially, what we do is we have an app that we use with our riders that we call it Powerwatz Online, and it's newly released. And embedded in that app are not just some training, some specific training that we like to use for the riders that looks at their efficiency and their pedal stroke balance, but also some embedded tests. And what we were doing on that particular day was some what we call maximum steady state lactate tests. And I was trying to determine where the threshold was for Chris in terms of his balance point of lactate production. And so I was looking at the results, and I'm going to leave it a question mark right now as to whether I was happy or not.
Oh, well, that is, I guess, I wonder if we'll ever find out.
We'll probably find out in July.
You have said, and I'm kind of paraphrasing you here, you said in one of your own Powerwatz podcasts that the beauty of coaching is that there's a riddle in every athlete. And you were discussing how people respond to training and about how to find what works best for them. Does Chris Froome pose any riddles for you so far?
Yeah, I mean, he was a big riddle because he's shown great capacity, obviously, in the past with all his victories, and has not been able to, or had not been able to, get to his previous best form in the last few years. And the question is why? There's not really only one reason as to why. Sometimes with athletes, the riddle has many different kind of places to go to look for the answer. And I think with Chris, it's a combination of several things. And it took us a while to dig through the data to see where the gaps were. And essentially, the challenge with Chris was that he never adequately came back to rebalancing his body post-injury. And this is a massive injury he had. He almost died. So, you know, what happened with him is he jumped into racing in a scenario where he was expected to put some, you know, serious power down on his pedals after a block of training. But his muscular system was not really necessarily completely ready to handle those kinds of loads. Certainly, when you look at his left to right balance and his efficiency patterns, you know, he was not really entirely ready to do that. And I'll tell you, this isn't in no way a reflection of anything badly done on Ineos's behalf, because I would have probably done the same thing. I mean, he's Chris Froome. You know, you rehab him and then you start building really as quickly as you can to build his aerobic foundation back so that he can perform. So I probably would have done the same thing. But when you look back at it, and it's easy to look back and make a judgment on it, but when you do look back, you start to see red flags. And one of the red flags is that he had started to develop a pedal stroke imbalance, especially when you look at left to right sides, where there was starting to be a significant delta in terms of one side putting out a certain power compared to the other. And that delta was increasing even before the injury. Of course, after the injury and his rehab, he brought it back to some degree, but he never brought it back to where it should be in order for him to be able to start to train to generate power like he used to. So what we did is essentially, it's like hitting the reboot button on your computer. We shut everything down and we said, phase one is, if he doesn't have the muscular system in order to support the power envelope we want him to get to, then it's not even worth trying to build the power envelope. So let's start from the basics. Let's build his muscular system, left to right sides, eccentric concentric loading in the weight room with some expertise at the Red Bull Center and with the help of Alex Battilli, his physiotherapist. We developed a plan, and the plan had one phase to it, which is let's get his muscular system back in balance and stronger. And we spent about 11 weeks doing that. And the second piece of that, which kind of happened halfway through the first phase, is to introduce the ability to transfer those strength gains and those balance gains onto the bike. And that required some pretty innovative strategies, things that Chris had never done before on a bike. And he, I think, really enjoyed the process and he bought into it because guess what? After about 6 weeks, we started to see the fruit being born from the seeds we had planted in the weight room. And I think in the last 4 weeks, approximately, it took a little while longer than we thought, but in the last 4 weeks, we have seen a rebalancing of Chris's pedal stroke and a starting to be loading him on the bike where he has not regressed back to old patterns. So I'm very satisfied with the progress he's made. And I'm hoping that we can continue to now evolve him on the bike to where he was.
What interests me about that is I imagine Chris Froome comes with a lot of, say, training literacy. He's been at this a while. He knows his body pretty darn well. And yet you guys were trying something new. I guess you're trying something new because of that significant injury that he still hasn't quite cleared. But how does he feel about new things and trying new things on the bike and in training?
Chris is actually an incredibly open-minded rider. He is refreshingly so in a sport that from the outside world looking in seems to be very innovative. From the inside of this sport, it's not extremely, it's very conservative. It's not very innovative in its mindset. Certainly a lot of the performance cultures on teams are not driven by that. But Chris is refreshingly so. This didn't happen in one conversation. This was multiple conversations backed up by a lot of testing and a lot of demonstration as to where the gaps were with Chris. And he's a smart guy. You know, when you show him the data and you have him realize that this is a big gap and you cannot get back unless this is addressed, then he's all in. And he's actually told me that it's been a really refreshing approach to his preparation. And he hasn't really prepared like this in the last 4 or 5 years, if ever. So I think he's motivated and he's also refreshed by the different stimulus that that we've introduced into the equation.
Another athlete you've worked with, and you've worked with this athlete much longer than Chris Froome, is Michael Woods. You guys started your collaboration around, I think, 2013, 2014. Michael Woods' running career was definitely over at that point, and you recognized that he was physically gifted, but also possessed another quality that could make him a successful cyclist. That quality was his ability to handle failure. How could you tell that he could handle failure? And why is that important?
Well, part of the process when I interview athletes and try to get inside their minds to see what kind of mindset they have is I ask them questions, very pointed questions about give me a scenario where you've actually failed. And how did you respond to that scenario? What's your mindset like? Are you defensive or offensive? Are you able to absorb that or does it kind of destroy you? You know, I've worked in Olympic sport for a number of years and with Olympic medalists and world champions in many different sports. And it's interesting over those years, I've come to see some patterns that are quite threaded across all these different champion athletes. And that is most athletes do not like failure at all. They just hate it. But the ones who typically succeed are the ones who are not afraid of it. They face it head on and they often get knocked on their butts because of it, but they're able to get back up and do it again. That constant fight against failure is a really important component for success for an athlete. Why is that? Well, it's because athletes fail infinitely more than they succeed. They fail in training a lot. They fail in racing a lot, especially bike racers. 180 join a race, only one wins. So that's 179 failures. So the point being that if you don't have a mindset that can cope with failure, then you're going to let that failure absorb into your body and define you. The ones who don't let it define them are the ones who often succeed. So I get inside, and I got inside Mike's head to find out a little bit about that. And then I would create scenarios for him to fail, to watch how he responds to it. It's actually a tool I use. And I can tell pretty quickly over the day or two after the failure what the success outcome of that athlete's going to be. For example, if an athlete gets really depressed and down and is just unable to get themselves out of a hole because they haven't succeeded at a particular task, and they're looking for reasons as to why, and they're almost obsessively looking as to what happened, that's not usually a great sign. It's a bit of a red flag. But Mike, yes, he's disappointed. He's like, damn, I couldn't get past that interval you sent me. It's like, oof, I want to do it again. I want to do it again. That is a recipe for success, because I know that the one constant in dealing with failure is effort and how they manage the throttle of effort. So for example, an athlete who fails, de-throttles his effort, is not going to succeed on a regular basis. But an athlete who fails and keeps throttling his effort, they're going to succeed, because that throttle is always going to go into the, it's Icarus, into the sun, you know, full throttle into the sun despite being burned. And that's Mike's mindset. And that's why he succeeds.
Over the years with Mike Woods, you've worked on various elements of his training and his technique. I'm thinking of how we all know he runs very well on his bike, quote unquote, that sort of out of the saddle, galloping uphill that he does. And then after that, you worked on his seated power. Right now, I'm thinking about his time trial. After last year's Tirreno Adriatico, in which he won a stage and wore the leader's jersey for two stages, he admitted later that he knew he wouldn't win the race overall because of the TT at the end. So to go back to this idea of riddles, what is the riddle to Woods' time trial, if you're in fact working on that today?
Yeah, we are. You know, with ISN, we have an interesting performance structure where we've put together a five-year plan. And in that five-year plan, we've built these performance pods within the context of the team. And one of the performance pods is a TT performance pods, where we've brought in a coach and a physiologist who specializes in optimizing performance for the TT. We didn't have that. And remember, Mike was on another team last year for the last few years, and I didn't really have the direct access and capability to be able to optimize that process. And not to say that EF was doing anything wrong. They weren't, you know, I think they were doing a great job with him. It's just that I didn't really have a full pathway of performance for optimizing his TT. And that's not putting it on their backs. It's putting it on mine, because I did make a decision early on with Mike that the riddle of the TT was a big one. And the small riddles of finding out how to make him an even better climber to the point where he would be world-class with the best in the world, that was really the biggest interest to me, because it was the lowest hanging fruit. And I said, I'd rather you win stages in Grand Tours than we take our focus away from that, make you a little bit of a better time trialist, but maybe it takes a little bit of way away from the upper end of you winning those stages. So it was a very logical decision to do that. Now we're going to really try and dial in a little bit more of his TT. He has improved his TT. It's just that it wasn't the big focus. And I think the reason that he hasn't evolved that piece is because it hasn't been such a big focus yet. Now, there are still some elements to figure out, and I'm hoping with our coach Kieran that we can do that on ISN. But at the end of the day, he's an upright rider who has a significant delta between the trunk flex position and the upright trunk extended position. And that delta was very big when he first started, and it's narrowed quite significantly. And he's become a better seated climber, and that seated climbing capacity has also improved his TT capacity. We've done a lot of work in the area. It's just one of those things that's a bit of a stubborn riddle to solve. And we're still working on it. There are a few things we're going to try this year with him. And we're hoping that with some different equipment that we can optimize that.
Michael Woods, as we all know, was a runner before he became a pro cyclist. Primoz Roglic was a ski jumper before he was a Grand Tour contender. Kelsey Mitchell, who has the world record for the flying 200 meters, was a soccer player before she came to the track. And I remember Steve Bauer back in the Spider Tech days batting around the idea of getting hockey players who were good, but not so good that they were in the NHL. He wanted these players on bikes. And maybe you were behind this because you were working with Spider Tech back in the days of that Canadian continental and pro-continental outfit. My question is cycling then an athlete's fallback sport? Now, I don't want to disparage any of these athletes who have done quite well in cycling, but if at first you don't succeed, try cycling? Is that the case, or is there something else going on there?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I'm a big believer of multi-sport access for kids. You know, I work with an organization called B210, and we have a big push into the physical literacy component of teaching kids how to move and remain healthy, which can eventually filter into positive outcomes in sport, which can eventually hopefully lead to more athletic accomplishment. But I do believe that it's a mistake to highly specialize kids into sport too early. And I believe that, you know, even Mike, you know, before he was a runner, he was a hockey player, and he thought he was going to play in the NHL. And I won't take the credit for the hockey initiative at Spider Tech. That was purely Steve Bauer's approach. But I do have a belief, and I shared that with him, that, you know, cross training in different sports brings different skill sets that can help later specialization. So it's less about the sport of cycling being a fallback sport, and it's more about having a 7-year-old start riding his bike and only specializing on his bike is not as good as having a 7-year-old play games and join a little soccer league and learn how to swim and learn how to play basketball, to be able to have diverse skill sets, which make them more balanced in their movement patterns. And being more balanced in your movement patterns and having better eye-hand coordination and different strengths and mobility and flexibility and timing and coordination, all of these things are so essential to the sport of cycling that coming from a different place reduces the hyper-focus that happens early on sometimes and keeps things fresh with athletes. Like Mike Woods started this sport late, as did Chris Froome, by the way. He started later than most. It keeps it fresh. They have longer careers. They're more continuously motivated because they haven't been at it for 25 years. So there's a mindset component. There's a physical literacy component about it that makes it so that you can evolve or continue to evolve in the sport for a long time. And cycling is a sport that you can take talent and mold that talent on the bike in a 3 to 5 year window fairly well, because it's a big engine sport that for some reason athletes can adapt to, especially if they have a good foundation of youth participation in sport. For example, hockey has a lot of crossover, as does cross-country skiing, for example, with cycling. So look for athletes in that sport that maybe have the slightly wrong phenotype for hockey. They're a bit too small, but they're fast. They have good engine, good aerobic engine, but that means they're a little bit slower than the fastest guys, but they would be great for cycling. So sometimes there are athletes who are misplaced in a sport that can do better in another sport. And cycling sometimes is the one they end up in because they're a bit smaller, so they end up taking cycling up in the summertime to train for their hockey season, and they love cycling. They end up being better at it, so they get more positive reinforcement from it, and they eventually maybe go into the sport. So that's kind of my assessment of that whole landscape of how people end up in the sport.
There has been a rise of apps in the last, I don't know, let's say 10 years for sure, that help people with their training, that can help them chart their training, recommend workouts, all kinds of stuff. Will apps and algorithms, will the robo-coach ever replace the real coach, the IRL coach?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a Kasparov deep blue question.
Exactly.
I don't know the answer to it at this point, and it's early days in terms of machine learning and AI and neural networks into coaching, because it's not like chess where there are very defined elements to it and extremely tight sets of rules. In coaching, you know, you're talking about subjective data combined with objective data together to make decisions. And I think what's going to happen in coaching is, and it's, this is stuff we're looking at for our app, for the future development of it, to incorporate some artificial intelligent components to it. For example, I don't know if you know this, but you know, the telephones that we have today, like an iPhone with its advanced camera and facial recognition, already have the elements in it to see what's happening with your face. In other words, if you can measure facial strain, then you could easily write up an algorithm that shows normal and duress facial strain and can adjust training accordingly indoors. So you can have a telephone that is watching a rider and making adjustments to that rider's prescription based on facial strain, as an example. That's a small example, but it's an area that we're looking at going into with our app. And there are many others, for example, using data through regression to look at where the numbers are and how we can adjust a future prescription with those numbers. So I think that big data mining is here to stay, and how we use it to help coaches is going to be an interesting scenario for us. I just don't see, though, given a lot of the subjective nature of coaching, that coaches will become bots. They'll be replaced by bots, because it's going to be a long time, I think, until the art component of coaching is replaced by a bot. I think the science component of coaching will be easier to kind of replace, because machine learning can look for deep patterns that the human mind cannot necessarily see. So I think it can be additive to the impact of coaching. But look, coaching is really about the fine balance of leveraging off of science and art and using those two pieces differently for different athletes. You know, that's really tough to teach a machine to do that, because there's a lot of experiential stuff that comes from the years of coaching that are very hard to program in, because you'd need coaches from many different venues across all kinds of spectrums to put that into rule sets that a machine can use. And that's going to be a long time coming, I think, before that comes into play. For now, I'll just take some projects where we can build tooling to help coaches make decisions based on data. And oftentimes it's like HRV data. Heart rate variability is information that we use to look at fatigue, but we don't use it as the single reason to make a decision. We use it as an additive reason. For example, if I have an athlete and I see the HRV values going down, but that athlete is in a place where I want them to be overreaching to a degree, then I don't use HRV to say, well, let me decide to now remove that stress. I use it to say, I understand they're under stress, but let me continue to add to that stress until I get a super compensation after the recovery. So all these pieces are additive to the equation, but we can't use them as a blind rationale to make one decision. I don't know if that makes sense, but you know, it's early days yet to see how these things are going to evolve.
You mentioned data, and data is such a feature of whatever of our lives right now. But in terms of training, I also understand you have access to reams and reams of data, and I understand you also can get lost in it for hours at a time. You enjoy it. But is there ever a moment where there's diminishing returns on all the number crunching? Is there a time when you know yourself, you're like, okay, I've got all I can get with these numbers. It's time to either go into action or, like you said, maybe manage those numbers or ignore those numbers.
Yeah, you can get definitely lost in the data. And it's a beautiful thing to go through this process now, because I have over many years been lost in data from time to time. But the important part is it's a micro to macro perspective. So there's data that is actionable and there's data that is interesting, and the two don't always intersect. And from my perspective as a coach, what I've come to learn, and as the head of performance at ISN, I've come to learn, is that it's okay to be interested in data, and to maybe use data to think through maybe an innovative tool or strategy, but use it in a way that allows you to pull back and look at the big picture. Okay, Paulo, sometimes I find myself sitting there going, now that you've dug into the data here for 3 or 4 hours, you have all these nice fancy graphs. What does the athlete need? Is this useful to them? How can it help you make a decision for the next training session? Or can it? If it can't, then you leave it there as something interesting to poke and prod at in the future, but you don't use it. So having that filter to be able to go from micro to macro is important. And what happens sometimes with coaches is that they always operate in the micro. And they think that just because you can collect it, then you need to use it. And having an ability to make a decision to leave data on the side is important. And doing that or making that decision allows you to transcend across from data and science into art and feel. And that's something that I've developed over the years because I come from data and science and I've moved across and I actually realize in the last 5 or 6 years that it is more important for me to hone my skills in the art, science, feel, and subjective component of coaching than it is in the data. And that is really been insightful for me to experience over the last few years. And I'm telling you, it has made me a much better coach. And what's interesting about that is it also had made me realize that the more you get to know an athlete and the more that athlete evolves, the less they need your data and the more they need your subjectivity, the more they need that connection, that human piece that allows you to say the right thing at the right time that's not even rooted in data. It's rooted in understanding the mindset of the athlete. Both of them tie up really, really well, but you have to be able to pull out of one and go into another and vice versa.
What I find super interesting about that is I'm hearing that you've applied almost your own methodology onto yourself because you've said that people tend to focus on what they're good at in training as athletes. If you're a hill climber, you want to go do hills. And maybe I'm extrapolating too much. You can pull this back a bit if you want. But I imagine data comes very easily to you and the sort of you like to get into it. But then you realize that you need to do this other element in your training as a coach to focus on that artistic subjective element.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I don't know if you know Dr. Steve Norris, who was an influencer for me. He's a great physiologist who's based out of, I think, Calgary now. And, you know, he introduced this concept to me called Kaizen. It comes from Japan, and it's essentially a methodology to it translates into essentially a quest for self-improvement. And that's how I try to build the performance structure of this team. And it's also my own mindset towards my own coaching career. And when you do that, when you think in terms of that kind of mindset of a perpetual search for self-improvement, you recognize very quickly that you have gaps. And when you recognize that you have gaps and you accept that, then you try and work on those gaps. And you're right. I mean, that was something that, although I had a predisposition to good subjective understanding and building relationships with athletes, I tended to over-leverage the data component and I tended to be weighted on the science piece. Because when you do go through school and you do some graduate work and you do understand the scientific method, you almost have this indoctrinated approach of, you know, it's the data. It's got to be scientifically based. You have to have the data to back it up. And interestingly, it makes you blind to a degree to the other piece. And it's only when you start to recognize your gaps that you start to recognize that there's something else outside of science. An interesting piece to this is, and I talk to our coaches about this on our team, is every time I hear somebody say, well, that's not evidence-based, I say to them, you know, why does it have to be evidence-based? So think about this. A lot of the innovations that have been proven in laboratories, where do they come from? They come from the field. They come from coaches and athletes having tried new and different outside-the-box approaches to a solution that they want to get, to an outcome that they want. If all those coaches had ever done was said, well, no, we can't try this because there's no evidence to demonstrate that it works, none of these innovations would have happened. So I encourage the fact that there's no evidence. Of course, maybe it'll be backed up by research laboratories and validated by a bunch of universities down the road, but it's in the field that we lead that. And that's why I encourage coaches and athletes to try new things, to try a different approach. That is, in a sense, the ethos of our coaching group at ISN. I don't want to quash the innovative spirit. I don't want to disregard the scientific foundations of things, but I don't want to use that as the gateway to trying something new all the time. So that's how I operate. And I think it really leads to great outcomes and to thinking outside the box and to whiteboarding ideas for our athletes. It's a new and innovative approach, that's for sure.
Tell me if there's a connection between the tech incubator, Startup Nation Central, which is where Startup Nation, that name, comes to your team name. But tell me if there's a connection between Startup Nation Central and the work you do with athletes for the World Tour races.
I tell you, I mean, there is for sure. And this I have to send in a shout out to Sylvan Adams, a friend of mine and the principal funder of the team, along with Ron Baron and Kevin Hamm. But with Sylvan, I have a special relationship with him, and he's always had a keen interest in sports physiology and applied sports research. When he formed that partnership with Startup Nation Central, he put me into a hub of an innovative group that we leverage off of that piece quite significantly. Of course, it's been a little bit curtailed with COVID now. But to give you some color to what I'm saying, you know, he set up a system where Startup Nation Central would send me, out of their 6,600 innovative companies, a group of categories of companies, what they do, whether it's sports nutrition or communication or load monitoring or you name it. And I would sift through these companies, these startup companies, and I would choose ones that might have an application to sport, and eventually to being able to help our athletes. And then I would go to Israel and I would sit there for a day or two, and I would have the key technology people from that company and come in and pitch me for 30 minutes on what their company does. And I would do this, like, we're talking about 8 or 10 companies, one after another. And then we would select 3 or 4 that might have some interesting appeal. And then we would pilot test some of those products. And maybe eventually then that would lead to research into the product or even testing it with our athletes to be able to use it as a tool, even before there was research to back it up. So yes, using Israel Startup Nation as a hub, an incubator for Israeli startup tech, and merging that or leveraging it for the team is something we do, and we're going to continue to do in the future, not just across Israel Startup Nation Central, but even into the university. Tel Aviv University and Ben Gurion University are two centers that Sylvan Adams has supported and is building research institutes at those universities to support our, not only our team, but applied sports research.
Can you tell me about any discoveries, breakthroughs, projects that have come out of those meetings with these tech companies that are helping the team possibly?
I could, but I'm going to hold off right now. But, you know, they're, like I said, it's been a little bit put on hold, but we are looking at some activity monitors that do some different things. We are looking at some garments that do some different measurements. There's some military pieces to the application as well. So we're a little bit mummed on the discussion of those elements. There's a communication component to some of the stuff we're looking at. There's using machine learning to build tooling for making race selections. There's a scouting component that we're looking at. But I'm going to speak in generalities because a lot of those things are in their infancy and have yet to be evolved. But we're definitely looking at some of that stuff, even nutritional tooling to embed in our athletes to monitor intake and things like that. These are all very, very interesting technologies that we're looking at combining some testing with our athletes with companies for the next 3 or 4 years. Like I said, we're in our first year really of a 5-year plan, And these things will come into play bit by bit as our team evolves and develops.
I find this fascinating. I feel like somewhere in there is the power meter of the late 80s, but you know, the rest of the world doesn't really know about it yet. And this is something that'll maybe trickle down to humble masters riders like me, maybe in 15 years. But maybe on that topic, is there something that maybe you see, not in the laboratories of Startup Nation, but something else maybe that you see that will trickle down to us amateur or recreational riders in the next little while? Do you foresee maybe what the next power meter is, or equally important development in training?
I think some of the interesting texts that are going to come out are really based on mining for loads on different athletes with different phenotypes. In other words, what types of athletes can handle what types of loads and what's optimal for your phenotype as a rider, and using some machine learning techniques to see what's optimal in terms of prescription for a particular athlete. There's also some interesting work being done. I don't know if you've seen Super Sapiens, but some real-time blood glucose monitoring. We're playing around with trying to mine data to look at using that as a way to achieve ideal body composition for athletes at different parts of the season. Body composition is definitely a key component of getting somebody into the right performance envelope. It's maybe a little bit less important for somebody who's recreational, but certainly a competitive masters athlete would want to know all these things, and it will trickle down at some point in time. But I think the deeper projects that we're working on are very much at the pointy end of the spear for elite athletes, and will hopefully, I think 90% of what we're going to do is probably going to fall by the wayside, and eventually we'll end up with the crux of all the stuff that is usable and functional. It's just like data. 90% of what I collect, I probably don't use that much, but it took me collecting 100% of the data in order to refine the 10% that's extremely useful. And that's kind of what we're taking as an approach to using some of these technologies to find out the diamonds in the rough of what is really useful and functional for athletes. So that's kind of where we're going with it. And what trickles down to the masters and the recreational athletes, time will tell. I think the blood glucose monitoring has some interesting implications. That's probably one you'll see a little bit more of in the future.
What are you looking forward to this year, in this year of racing and your work with the team?
First of all, I have to say that, and thanks again to Sylvan for putting me in this job. You know, he asked me to help this team, and it's like you've put me in a candy store and you've locked me in there, and I'm locked in there all night, and all I'm doing all day is eating candy and all night is eating chocolate, because this is a candy store. I mean, it's a dream job for me, I have to say. And I'm so grateful that I'm in this position. I really, really am. You know, my goal is really one where we can continue to evolve as a team and really punch above our weight as a squad. We are not the biggest budget team by far. In fact, we're probably on the lower end, maybe, or middle end of the spectrum. And I love the underdog concept. I love to be able to punch above our weight. And in order to do that, we have to make sure that all of our riders can get as close to their physiological and mental potential as possible. So for me, that is my goal ultimately, is can we get to the tip of everyone's potential, and whatever that is, whether it's the potential as the best domestique and teammate, so being as physiologically ready to play that role, or it's the top end GC rider who wants to try and win another grand tour. Those all are the same. They're optimizing somebody's performance to get to their physical potential and their mental potential. If we can do that, then I will have been very satisfied with a job well done. Wherever that takes us, I'll be very satisfied. So punch above our weight and reach our potential is really where I want this team to be. Without giving you specifics on, oh, we're going to be first or second or 10th or 8th in this race. Because as you know, cycling is really a chaotic sport, and sometimes things happen that make it impossible to get a victory in a particular day. So I don't love the idea of earmarking one day where you're going to get one result, because chaos plays a role in that equation and can derail those efforts. What I like to look at is preparing an athlete to get them into a convergence of many different factors that put them in what I call the performance envelope. And when you're in the performance envelope and you're presented with a competitive landscape, and if you make the right decisions and you're lucky in that competitive landscape, then there's a very good chance that you'll perform really well. That's how I look at performance in road cycling. And I'm hoping our guys can get to that place.
Paulo Saldana, thank you very much for your time today. This was super fascinating to delve into all these topics with you. And good luck with the season ahead.
All right, no worries. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And that's the episode. It's written and edited by me, Matthew Piorro. I had help from web editors Terry McCall and Lily Hansen-Gillis. Lily has a feature on our website about Saldana and Sylvain Adams of Israel Startup Nation. Check it out. The link is in our show notes. The Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast is produced by Adam Killick. He composed the music, too. Thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. And thank you for listening. Please rate and review the show. Ride safely, whether indoors or out, and I'll talk to you later.